and welcome to East Meets West. I'm Olga Bataman.
I'm Tara Reid. Well, you're back. You've been traveling and you're back, and you had quite an exciting time. I saw some of the videos, and I've been sharing them with our audience, and I hope you follow Olga on X, please, and follow us also on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm back from St. Petersburg Economic Forum, and it was really exciting because can you imagine 25,000 of participants, all of the ministers, for the first time throughout the last couple of years, the U.S. official delegation was there as well, and like 143 states represented there. So definitely that's the biggest event of the year. And we'll discuss our emotions about it with the guest we're having with us. But before we turn to our guest, let me just briefly comment on what happened overnight. As you may know, Ukraine attacked the train going from Moscow to Crimea. The driver, one driver was killed, the other one was injured. And you know what, at this time of the year, those trains are mostly carrying kids, because the kids are going for their summer vacations, summer camps, granny is taking their grandchildren to the sea, you know, families traveling with their kids as well. So again, they are deliberately targeting kids.
Children. Yeah.
Just the other day in Lysychansk, two teens aged 14 and 15 were attacked by a drone. They were riding their bicycles. And we've discussed the Starobelsk tragedy here as well. But, you know, I want to address those of us watching from Europe. Maybe you can bring it to your leaders. You know, terrorist organizations, they're the same everywhere. And if you feed a beast with your hand, once it will bite your hand, definitely. And we already see it happening while we were at Spiev, where, as I said, official U.S. delegation was presented. Ukraine was attacking the area where the forum was held, with dozens of drones that were intercepted, and the oil refinery plant was hit. And it was very close to the area where the forum was held. So they're already doing it. And we discussed during our last episode, Ukraine is getting closer and closer to hitting the reactor of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. So guys, it's already happening. Be aware of that and bring it to your leaders. Once again, if you feed a beast, once this beast will bite your hand.
And to Americans, you know, like, you know, Donald Trump just needs to lift the sanctions off Russia. They need to stop Starlink and stop feeding the weapons to Ukraine. That just needs to happen. And it's, you know, so you hear the Trump administration talking about peace, talking about not supporting anymore this basically a proxy war that was started. But I think someone, Lavrov made a good point. He said the proxy war in Ukraine has now gone from Biden to Trump. It's now Trump's war.
Well, I've talked to a number of, I've talked to Kirill Dmitriev, first of all, at Spiev, Russian presidential envoy on the negotiations with the United States. I've talked to Robert Age, who is the head of American Chamber of Trade here in Russia. And they both confirm, and I was surprised to hear that, that negotiations between Russia and the United States are ongoing. They have, they communicate more than once a week. They communicate several times a week.
Good.
I was surprised to hear from Robert Age personally. You know what he said when I asked him about the open letter of Zelensky? And we'll discuss it with our guests, but just briefly, I asked Robert Age, what does he think of that? And I was surprised to hear him saying, we always say that to end the war, you need Russia to want to end it, but you also need Zelensky's will to end it. And he said that once the conflict is settled, the sanctions would be lifted and the business would get to normal. So that's what the American side is already saying. But maybe let's discuss it with the guest who is here with us today, and who was also a participant of Spiev this year, and who maybe will be our compatriot in the very near future, hopefully. Chris Hilali with us today. Chris, Happy to have you in our studio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you both.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
So maybe first, could you elaborate on this newsy thing, your open letter to the president of the Russian Federation, where you asked for the citizenship? What were your motives behind that?
Yes, for sure. I mean, for a long time, I've been involved in activities trying to build bridges with Russia. Most people who know me for a long time know that in high school, I was president of the Russian History Club. I studied under a Sovietologist, Dr. Carl Wilson, who was a professor at Clark University. So in my youth, I was very active in Russian culture, Russian language, even though my Russian language is not so good. But I did study it for a year in high school as well. We did work with the Museum of Russian Icons, the largest Museum of Russian Icons in the Western Hemisphere, which is located just about 30 minutes from where I grew up. So we would go there all the time. We would do work there. I've lectured there before, done research there. And because I grew up in a family that, with my mom being from Greece, of course, for my grandparents, Russia was not only Third Rome, Second Jerusalem, and the Orthodox component, and the fact that where I come from in Greece is the last capital of the Byzantine Empire, and you know, our heritage goes back to the Byzantine Empire. My great-grandmother, her family name is recorded in Byzantine manuscripts, so all of this connects us. There was a lot of roots. You know, of course, there are Greek areas of Russia, so that was also part of that. Crimea, Mariupol, Stavropol, all these places, they are all Greek in origin. And for me, you know, throughout the years, I've been working towards building that friendship. Of course, politically, being a member of the Communist Party, the Soviet Union's legacy. And then 2014 happens, and we are active with supporting the Donetsk People's Republic, Lugansk People's Republic, of course, supporting Crimea. I wrote letters. I was involved way before 2022. Even I published an article before the special military operation outlining the history for going back to the Treaty of Kuchuk-Kanarji, if you know, from Catherine the Great, and about Crimea and the war with the Ottomans and all of this. People had no clue. And even still now, people don't really know the origins of a lot of the issues that are at play. The fact that there was really no Ukraine until modern history, and Ukrainian nationalism is a byproduct of that modernity. And so I tried to really explain these kinds of things. I had friends on both sides, had good friends of mine who I was communicating with since 2014, Russell Bentley, Texas in Donetsk, who sadly has passed away. All of these things were part of my life. So I tried to come in 2020. We were supposed to go to Lugansk, and then COVID happened, so we got stopped. And then from 2024 onwards, been very active, went to Lugansk and Donetsk, spoke at the UN multiple times with the Russian mission. And then since I moved here in April 2025, of course, some months ago, I wrote a letter to President Putin. And, you know, I basically outlined in four pages the work that I've done, the efforts that I've put into friendship, and I requested citizenship. Of course, it's up to him, and I hope for a positive response, but I leave it to his hands and to his blessing. And as we say, inshallah, hopefully, you know, proto theos, as we say in Greek, I will one day be your compatriot here. And I look forward to continuing to be a good citizen and a good participant and a good worker and a good moral and ethical compass in the society as we move forward.
And maybe to our viewers who say that there are no foreigners left in Russia after the special military operation started, guys, if you only knew how many foreigners came to Russia after the special military operation started, and I mean, some of them even going to front lines, so.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's important. I think it's important to bring the stories and what's happening to the Western audiences. You know, we're just releasing a video today. I interviewed a Ukrainian POW in Kursk Oblast, and it's exclusive. He surrendered to North Korean troops, and he told me the story. And he told me the situation, how they communicated with each other. They had little cards in Korean, Ukrainians. So this poor conscript, he said, I didn't even want to go. He said, I have family on both sides, right? Because a lot of these, this is really a civil war.
Yeah.
This is a civil war.
Yes, it is.
It's a civil war between people who are family. There are families on both sides. If you go to Kursk, they have family in Sumy. They have family in all of those regions of Ukraine.
Chris, all over Russia, it's the same thing. You can never divide if a person is Ukrainian or a person is Russia. Even the language, according to all of the linguistical rules, there are no different language, Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian. Those are dialects.
Correct.
They're scientifically proved.
Correct.
Yeah. So
absolutely. So this is one of the saddest parts, one of the horrors of this whole episode, is that this has been a civil war trying to wrench apart peoples who were united for 1,000 years. We're not talking about yesterday or a century ago. We're talking about 1,000 years. When we write in history and we read in our textbooks, Kiev and Rus, when we speak about where the baptism happened in Crimea, right, of Vlad, and we have the conversion into Orthodox Christianity, all of these things, they happen in that area. Mm-hmm. So of course, and people ask, well, why aren't they going harder? Why aren't they destroying? Russia is not Israel. Russia does not want to commit genocide against Ukraine. Ukrainians are their own. These are brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
This territory is historically theirs. So why destroy the monasteries that you built? Why destroy the heritage that you created? Mm-hmm. Ukraine was the richest of the Soviet Socialist Republics.
Right.
Everybody went to Kiev. People, I talked to older people, they said, I studied in Kiev. It was like a badge of honor. It was one of the things. Half of the premiers of the Soviet Union were Ukrainian. So for me, it's a real tragedy. It's a tragedy, and it's been created by the West to try to do this. And it's being pushed not only in Ukraine. You see it in the Baltic states. You see it in other Eastern European countries. Mm-hmm. You're seeing it now in the Caucasus with Armenia. We had the vote yesterday.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You see Pashinyan trying to wrench Armenia away from Russia.
And you know, the European Union, they send like a brigade there.
For sure.
It's to follow the Moldovan scenario.
For sure. And also in Georgia. So we know, remember the elections there and what ended up transpiring. There's nerves about Central Asia and what's going to happen there. All of the Central Asian leaders went together to the White House. And then after Tokayev came to Moscow. So there's a lot of concern that this encirclement, this containment, which was the policy of the United States during the Soviet period, during the Cold War, is continuing. And for me, it's as an American citizen, it's something that we need to fight back against. Russia is not the enemy.
Well, and that goes back to when I worked in the Senate and the Congress. And I can tell you in the 90s, I was there when Biden was talking about, and he said, and this was even documented, to McCain, he said, Russia will never have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And that's what he meant. They have been wanting to destroy Russia since the 90s. This has been the plan.
Yeah.
Trump, I thought, was deviating from the plan and moving away from that. I don't know if he really is, if he has too much opposition within or if he just kind of goes with the flow. But he seems to be more warlike or just as warlike as Obama, Biden. The same policies are continuing.
Absolutely. Listen,
and
for me, and you're, this is spot on, Trump is commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean he's a dictator, and it doesn't mean that he has full authority. The entire structure, the entire apparatus of the diplomatic corps, of the think tank crew, of the political elite, they are trained at the top universities, Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And I've studied at Dartmouth and Cornell and at Harvard Divinity School. For me, what do we learn there? We learn that Russia is an adversary, at best an adversary. At worst, it's the evil empire continued.
Right.
China is an adversary, North Korea is, and they're all rogue states, they're all sponsors of terror, right?
Right.
So that's why they link them now, Russia, China, Iran. Mm-hmm. They are the links now.
The axis of evil.
There's a new axis of evil, right?
Yeah,
and we grew up with that language, remember,
yes,
after 9/11. Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, right?
Absolutely.
So for me, when I look at this, I try to explain to Russians, Trump is but one person, but the people around him have a lot to gain from this continuing. And also, the U.S. cannot be number two. It's not in its DNA to be number two. Because of its history, and I was a U.S. history teacher, because of Manifest Destiny, because of the Republic's birth, and then the Republic's transformation to an empire in the later parts of the 19th century into the 20th century, the U.S. sees its role as historic.
Yeah.
It sees its role as spiritual. That it will try to remake the world in its image. Liberalism, capitalism, the free market, and its values. Its values, of course, end up breaking down to the McDonaldization of the world, right?
Well,
the
yeah,
marketplace.
Crony capitalism.
Absolutely.
And that's where we're at. And that's a cycle. And we've talked about this before, how, you know, political and economics have cycles. And right now the US is in crony capitalism. Now,
they just cannot accept it.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Russia's in the honeymoon
China,
period.
China, China.
Yeah, like
definitely.
Russia's got the honeymoon, but I hope that Russians will look to the U.S. and see the damage that's done by crony capitalism and how the military-industrial complex can take over.
Correct.
And then your economy and everything has to have enemies. It has to create enemies where there isn't any. And I think, you know, I look at President Putin and I listen to his speech. You know, it's Spiff, yeah. And his patience is really amazing, his diplomacy. But I wonder where it ends, right? You know what I mean? Like, I think
for
the
sure.
U.S. has
no,
pushed
he's just
it
not
as
an
far
impulsive
as...
person. He's
no,
a
no,
strategic
no. He's
thinker.
Very strategic.
Thinker, so.
But he's for being sure. very patient, and he's trying to give this administration a chance.
For sure. And he will. He will continue to do that, even with Starobelsk happening, even with all of these things. How can you... You and I, mm-hmm. growing up in the U.S.,
right.
living there, can you imagine... Not only $1 trillion military budget, now it's going to 1.5 trillion and a half.
And they've never passed an audit.
Never
seven audits.
They've never been able to do an audit. By the way, they weren't able to do an audit the day before. They were talking about, remember Rumsfeld's speech the day before 9/11.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
for me, when you look at all of this, of course you need an enemy, and a lot of people make a lot of money.
Yes, they do.
Think about Lindsey Graham and all of these types.
Yeah.
They're still there, they have tremendous power. We shouldn't underestimate that these people have power and play. And also, we shouldn't underestimate the fact...
the ones you don't see.
The ones you don't see. And the Democrats are going to probably take either the House, the Senate, or both in this upcoming midterm.
I know.
If they end up doing that, and if we go into 2028, and we have, say, for example, a Democratic presidency that then comes into the White House, I just want to tell everybody here, and I'm sure you know this, you both understand this, we're going to see more sanctions. We're going to see increased support for the European Union, increased support for NATO, because the
and
Democrats...
And moving towards World War III.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's the big fear. And that's why I think President Putin, as a strategic thinker, as a man who's rational, as a man who's not driven by emotions,
right?
He's not an emotional and impulsive figure.
They've been trying to provoke him for...
They are trying to provoke him because that's their goal.
A decade, yeah,
right.
or longer.
But just like even when Kennedy... See, the thing about history is it teaches us lessons. Khrushchev and Kennedy... when they came down to the moment, the key moment of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and those Soviet ships were ready to run the blockade, and it could have led, I mean, there were people on both sides, hardliners in the Kremlin and in the White House, who were ready to go. Curtis LeMay was like, I'm ready to bomb Berlin. Ready to bomb, we're gonna carpet bomb Cuba and we're gonna bomb Berlin.
McNamara
as well, and McNamara regretted it in The Fog of War, that famous documentary. He ended up saying, we came down, but the reason was, both Kennedy and Khrushchev fought in World War II, in the Great Patriotic War.
Right.
They were on the same
side.
They
remembered what
the
war was.
Absolutely, because Khrushchev wrote, he said, war does not end with us. It goes into every town and village and city and destroys everything.
Yeah.
So they pulled themselves back and they didn't allow the people around them to drag them into the war.
Fox.
The problem is...
And those people at the power now, who have the power now, they don't know what the war is.
No,
now that their kids do.
Correct, because they send other people's kids to go fight.
Yeah.
Or they sacrifice Ukrainians to go fight.
Exactly.
Right?
But they're dilettantes. They don't care. Even the President Trump has never experienced. He got out of the Vietnam War. Remember with
exactly,
his,
of course,
with
bones
the heel of his foot.
And now there's a whole action. You know, send your son to the war in Iran. But Chris, what I wanted to ask you, speaking about Trump. Another thing that happened overnight was the escalation in the Middle East.
Yes.
And we've heard about this fight between Trump and Netanyahu. Because Iran, it was a warning attack, because actually no one was killed, no one died. And even Trump realized that and put it to Netanyahu. So that it was a warning strike. And Israel started to reply, and then Trump had to intervene. And he was very harsh, from what I know, speaking to Netanyahu, said, stop it, we will continue the talks, and if they fail, then in a couple of days, we may resume together. So what do you think of that? Was this attack completely not coordinated with the United States, and now Trump has to, again, you know, shout at Netanyahu, or was something there else behind the scenes?
Listen, for me, it's a little bit good cop, bad cop type thing. I don't necessarily buy that there's this kind of tension. I think this is for our consumption, for the media and the public's consumption.
To make Trump look better.
Right, to make Trump look better. Like, oh, I'm the one who's actually doing the diplomatic route and Netanyahu. But they coordinate at every level.
They do.
They coordinate at every level.
I guess it's impossible for Israel to launch a strike without U.S. knowing.
And also, they are together. They're in the same. They have military advisors there on both sides.
Yeah.
There's Israelis in the Pentagon, and there's Americans over there in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. So
and they're merging the armies.
And they're merging the armies now. Mm-hmm. We just heard that.
It'll be
in
like
the past.
One.
Correct. So yeah. I think that this is just theater. This is just part of the psychological operation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I honestly believe that this war against Iran for Israel is existential for them. They see it as necessary.
Absolutely.
And also, Netanyahu knows that if this war ends, he might end up in a jail cell.
Yeah.
So he understands that he just continues it on. And because his coalition is made up of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and the rest of the far-right gang there, they are pushing and pushing and pushing. They want this. They don't want to stop.
Mm-mm.
And so I don't see any space by which we can have a diplomatic solution, unless Israel pulls back from the brink, and I don't see any sign that they're willing to do that. In fact, I could see, at best, a frozen-type conflict, where there's occasional shootouts, but there's actually no peace agreement.
Right.
That's where I think we're headed. The Israelis want to continue in Lebanon, and our beloved Steve Sweeney, who was on this great show, if you haven't seen it, definitely check out that episode. But Steve, and you know, we communicate all the time, Steve, in the south of Lebanon, has been very adamant. This is the largest ethnic cleansing since the Nakba. And even it's bigger than the Nakba, in the sense that over 1 million people have been displaced from the south of
million
Lebanon.
And a half
million
already,
and a half.
Which is 1/5 of their whole entire Lebanese population.
Correct. So think about that.
Humanitarian catastrophe.
Catastrophe.
1/5 of your population is being displaced.
Correct. But catastrophe for a country that cannot necessarily survive on its own, that is in economic ruin, and that has its own political crisis from within. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing the creation of another failed state scenario here, by which everyone can start to move in and take pieces, right? Everybody's moving on the border.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in the grand scheme of things, the blockade continues, which is an act of war against Iran. This is really no ceasefire. It's just not a big shooting war. But the war continues by other means.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we talk about sanctions as war by other means.
Mm-hmm.
The blockade continues. Iran continues to strengthen its resolve. And I think at the end, Iran has revealed that it cannot easily be defeated. And that if Trump does go into peace agreement, he's the one that's going to be losing on the losing end.
Mm-hmm.
Iran would have already showed its cards and its strength. And I think that they're trying to navigate how to do this in the appropriate manner.
To keep their face, right? While losing.
Correct.
While losing, yeah.
And I don't think that they found that formula yet, to be
Chris,
honest.
But from what I know, you went to Iran not that long ago.
Correct.
And you've been to Iran earlier, of course. So can I ask you, how do Iranians feel at this point of time? Because, you know, it was hard even for me, because I went to Iran twice, it was hard even for me to see the streets that I walked in, you know, or the square where I had coffee being in ruins now. How do Iranians feel right now?
Iranians
and
are...
Why wasn't the regime, the country, defeated by the assassination of their supreme leader? Just I wanna have your perspective as an Iranian to an extent.
For sure. I think that if you understand Iran, you understand two pivotal things. First of all, Iran is a civilization state.
Mm-hmm.
Iranian history goes back 5,000 years.
Right.
So there, people are very patriotic. People love their country.
Mm-hmm.
Their country, as it looks on the map, has been that way more or less for far longer than the U.S. and Israel have been around the states, times many.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, they might have disagreements with the government. And there are plenty of people who have disagreements about the economy and this and that. But if a foreign invader comes, and they are very well attuned to what happened when other invaders came, they don't tolerate it at all. No matter who it is, nobody is allowed to... Iranians see their soil as sacred. Just like Russians do when we have the songs like Sacred War. This is a sacred war for Iran. They call it that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even non-religious people,
even
people from different religious traditions, Armenians, Jews, Assyrians, you name it, they're in the fight. And when I went there, we went to synagogue, we went to Armenian churches, we saw so many different people. Even women without hijab. Now 50% almost of Tehran, nobody's wearing hijab. Everyone's like, oh, feminism. Most women in Iran that are upper, they don't wear it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Religious women wear it, and you know what? Nobody complains. Nobody. And these are women without hijab, not even religious, piercings, tattoos. They're holding pictures of Supreme Leader. I want to just emphasize that Iranians, regardless of their disagreements, have united in a way we have never seen before.
Right.
Never.
That's what I saw.
Absolutely.
And when I saw the president of Iran walking in the crowd.
In the crowd.
Remember, and people are coming up to him. They're making pictures with him. They're giving him some gifts and some flowers.
Kissing him everywhere,
and,
of course.
And he's just walking in the crowd.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think you cannot see in any other country in
no.
the world, and Trump,
no,
even
no.
Trump or Biden, they wouldn't no. walk in the crowd of
Not
their
like
own
that.
Citizens, yeah. you know?
Correct.
No. Yeah.
Correct. And I think that was the key takeaway for me. I was there for about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was so surprising. From north to south, I started in the border of Armenia, in mm-hmm. East Azerbaijan province, Tabriz, whether it's Azeri, Persians, Lors, Kurds, Arabs, Baluch people, everybody was united. Because Iran is made up of a mosaic of different ethnic groups, mm-hmm. much like Russian Federation.
All right.
So
right.
all the people were united. Mm-hmm. All the people. It was
right.
shocking to me. And everybody said, we want the revenge. Especially because I went to Minab.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the school. I met with family members. I went to the house of young parents who lost their daughter, their only daughter. Mm. And I saw the backpack, I saw her ID, I saw all of the things, blood soaked. And for me, you could sense the real mm-hmm. tragedy, you could sense the loss, the pain, mm-hmm. and you could sense the rage. Mm. That they sent their daughter to school and she should have been safe.
Yeah.
They said, we don't mind if in a war they attack military. That's what the military is for. I'm a soldier. If I die in war, it's my job. That's right.
My
That's
choice.
What we do, right? That's our job description. But a kid going to school,
yeah,
they are going to school. They want to come home to their family. They are not a militant. They are not a soldier. Their job is to go and get an education and come home to their families. And you see these young lives, but 120 mm-hmm. young kids stripped away by multiple U.S. Tomahawk cruise missiles. I went to the cemetery and there were families grieving at these graves. They were fresh, you could tell. We just made them all with beautiful pictures of them, flags everywhere. And it was very overwhelming. I cried. I actually, Wyatt Reed of the Gray Zone and I, we were hugging each other very, very emotional, overcome with emotions because of the pain that these people felt and the pain that we felt. Because if you have humanity, you feel that.
Mm-hmm.
You feel that and you say, my tax dollars built that Tomahawk cruise missile to kill my own people. Right, it makes me even more angry when I was there.
But again, you see, it's like the same scenario of attacking kids, of attacking colleges, schools, trains, kids riding bicycles.
Yes,
it's like the same method they apply everywhere.
And exactly. The methodology of using drones now to even take away the humanity
of course.
Component of it.
Of course.
So you have, like, there's not even trained soldiers sometimes making these decisions. They're tech guys, right?
And they're AI
they're
systems.
Tech guys.
Yeah.
And they don't care. Or the AI
like the
systems.
Exactly.
Or they're the tech guys just with the,
Exactly.
And so they're going to make huge errors, huge mistakes. Right, because Google Maps doesn't have, you know what
Correct.
I mean? Like, right, and also just the separation of the humanity of it is so, and you know, it strikes me that people in America rave about President Obama being this great humanitarian. He droned more civilians than any president in history
Correct.
Until now,
Correct.
And now Trump might beat him.
Correct.
But like, what are your thoughts about the methodology in war right now with the more and more use of AI, drones, robots, and all that?
You know, I can link two things for us because I think they're important. So I was at Minab, and clearly you're right. Some AI system, which saw this place as a base from before, they plugged in the coordinates, just clicked the button, and then sent the missiles
Was
there.
It not updated AI system? Because it was for 10 years, I think, it was a school there.
Even more than that,
even
it
more
was
than
a school.
10 years, yeah.
The thing was, they just feed it whatever information they have. So if they don't update the information, it just uses the information that they have available to it. So if they have old
as
information...
Bad as that,
AI
as bad
will
as that.
Even use Reddit. Like, when you ask AI a question, it'll use Reddit threads. Which are nonsense.
Correct.
So no one cares
Correct.
About accuracy at
no.
all.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So go on.
So when you look at what happened in Minab, and then you look at Starobelsk, and
it's
I went
the
to
same.
Starobelsk.
It's the same.
Right? May 22nd, we got on a plane. First time ever I went to the Donbass by plane, military plane. We all got 50 journalists. We went over there. And when we got on the ground, I was overcome with just emotion that the scale of destruction. I've been now 3 years going back and forth to the Donbass.
Yeah.
I had never seen one civilian site hit so many times in so many different places. Okay, you had 1, 2, 3 HIMARS hit a place or some drones, mm-hmm. but 16.
They were deliberately 16. Hitting the building while the kids were trying to escape. Yeah. When yes. they were going down the stairs.
Correct. They were targeting them.
And they were already asleep. So they yeah. already so they pajamas, targeted them in right. the middle of the night. These kids are sleeping. We saw their the dorms. We saw, you could still see in
and
the
collapsed
sections.
And they were losing their slippers running down the stairs.
Correct. Yeah. I saw the slippers. I saw blood-soaked, you know, objects and things. You could still smell. Mm. I mean, you could still, for me, having been a soldier
yeah.
and having experienced war in Syria, you could still have that sense of death, smell. Right? Mm-hmm. That smell yeah. of death. And it was very emotional for me because on the wall, there was an entire 5 stories collapsed. And our colleague, Murad Gazdiev, who was mm-hmm. there, said that he could hear the screams
yeah.
of the kids.
When they arrived there.
When
yeah.
they arrived there.
They
were still alive, you know? And of course, the great and heroic crews, the firefighters, the first responders, the emergency crews, they only can work with what they have, and they were working as quickly as possible.
And they were crying but themselves,
of course.
Guys.
Yeah, they were very emotional. They were overcome with emotions. Mm-hmm. On the wall of the collapsed part, I took video of it, the kids still had the pictures of themselves and their friends and family members.
Yeah.
You could see it on the open walls.
Yeah.
You could see all these things. I saw stuffed animals, you mm-hmm. know, Pikachu, this and that, because the kids were studying, some of them were studying to be
yeah.
teachers.
Yeah.
So if this was a professional school, so it was yeah. becoming teachers or engineers, technicians, computers.
Kindergartens computer. As
yeah.
well.
Kindergarten, exactly. So for me, having been to both Minab and to Starobelsk, for me, I was overcome because I said, in 2 different parts of the world, divided by language, culture, religion, everything, the same collective West
method,
does
yeah.
this. The same methods, the same methodology, as you were saying, being utilized in this way. And that for me was really something that hit me at my core. Because mm-hmm. instead of CNN joining us,
mm-hmm.
instead of CNN joining
us, and BBC
us,
as well.
And BBC, well, I'll get to BBC in a second. Instead of CNN joining us, which they were invited for, they went to the Ukrainian side to a drone unit, and they took footage of the drone unit while they were launching drones at Russian areas.
Wow.
And they showed the Palantir system that was being utilized, mm. right? That they decided not to go to Starobelsk, where 21 kids, 19 right. girls, 3 boys were brutally murdered. And they instead went to the Ukrainian side, which were the ones that launched the drones.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of journalism in this? The BBC didn't
well, they're
come.
They're not. They're stenographers.
They're stenographers. As we've yeah. said, they're stenographers for the Epstein class. That's how I'm yeah. going to say it. And I don't have any qualms about it.
Yeah.
BBC, Steve Rosenberg was at SPIEF. And Sasha and I confronted yeah. him. We were together.
Yeah.
We confronted him. He said something very interesting because he started to talk about Kursk. And he said, for 2 years, this was Rosenberg speaking, for 2 years I've tried to go to Kursk and I have not been allowed. We haven't been given authorization. I said, Steve, I've been to Kursk twice. I've been to Suja while our little electronic equipment was beeping that FPVs were everywhere. I don't know how I could have gone because I'm a nobody. And how you, journalists at BBC, Moscow, you know, mm-hmm. You know, what is it? Moscow
Bureau.
Branch,
like
Moscow
Bureau.
Correspondent,
yeah.
Moscow Bureau.
Bureau.
Moscow yeah, Bureau of the BBC. You can't get into Kursk and Suja?
Yeah.
When?
Oh, but I mean, even why should you talk about Kursk? He was invited there.
He was personally invited
to go to Starobelsk.
Exactly.
And he didn't.
And listen to this. So his excuse was, because we weren't allowed to go to Kursk, we said, well, if Starobelsk is happening, it might be very dangerous for us. So we weren't allowed to go. I said, but your job is a journalist.
You should be covering fashion then.
Yes,
or maybe
exactly.
cuisine.
Exactly.
I don't
know, or sports,
something like sports,
as Sasha said, you know. But that's the thing that for me that was very evident was that they are not interested in telling the truth. And if
no.
they do tell the truth, they have to expose the Western complicity in all of this. The Western hand
exactly.
behind
he's,
it all.
He's a paid propagandist.
For sure.
He's never going to. Like you saw, like before I came in here, the big takeaway from SPIF was his article about the drone attacks on St. Petersburg.
Yes.
Not the president's speech, not everything else, but just like the smoke and how SPIF was ruined and how isolated Russia is. Russia's not isolated.
Nope.
How many countries?
143.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. He got an invite to SPIF. Like, why are they inviting that guy?
Unlike RT correspondents in
yeah,
the United
yeah,
States
yeah.
Like, or
like
elsewhere
why,
in Europe.
Why in the world would they invite someone who's obviously openly hostile? So it's just interesting, like, I had gotten a call from Fox over the weekend because they thought I was going to SPIF and I didn't go, so I couldn't give them the story. So it would have made national, at least and Fox, too bad I wasn't there. But, so we did something else. But, you know, there are outlets in the United States trying to get the story.
For sure.
But instead, you have, like, Steve Rosenthal, who's able to, you know, get the Western media and wrangle it.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I wanted, what I wanted to say is, like, when you're describing all that, what you saw in Starobelsk, so I guess it's very easy to understand President Putin's reaction when he was asked about Zelensky's open letter, just that was published when SPIF was taking place, and the moderator asked President Putin at the plenary session about his reaction and whether he would accept the invitation of Zelensky to meet him. I think President Putin's reaction was just brilliant, because he only replied with one phrase, the first part of which was addressing all of, like, from soldiers to generals, all of the militants, irrespective of the rank. And that's a part of the official address of the chief commander of Russia. And the second part was, keep at it, brothers. And for us in Russia, everyone knows what it means. This phrase, if maybe, like, some of the viewers don't know, let me just give some background behind this phrase. It belongs to a policeman who was killed, a Dagestani policeman who was killed while having a picnic with his family. And then, like, the remains of a terrorist organization came up and they killed his brother. So they attacked them and they killed him, but they were filming that with their phones. So before they killed him, they asked this policeman to address his colleagues in FSB, in police, in the Ministry of Internal Affairs, so that they quit and they don't do this job. And that what was he replied, just keep at it, brothers. So this is a very calm confidence in pursuing what you consider to be the right thing to do. That was what President Putin replied. And when he was asked once again by the moderator, so would you accept the invitation? He said, there's no point in it.
No, exactly. Yeah, there is
no
point.
What was maybe you can elaborate on that, on the Zelensky's letter and presidential reaction to that?
Listen, I mean, this was a show. This was once again another opportunity for Zelensky to get his name in the media.
And
by the way, the letter was never delivered by diplomatic channels.
Correct.
It's like mere PR action.
Correct, which is why Peskov said, you know, the President Putin's press secretary said, you know, if you would do it the right way, we would have delivered it to President Putin, he would have seen it. But since you opened it up and you tried to make a show of it, what's there to comment on, really? It's not a diplomatic letter, it's a publicity stunt, right?
Right.
And that's really what it was. It was an opportunity for Zelensky to get his name in there. And why acknowledge
it? Because he's asking for more money from Europe.
Of course, and so that's what he's doing. He's trying to say, oh, look, you know, look, and to put President Putin on the spot, because he knew that this would come up. This is why he did it. But President Putin didn't entertain it. He didn't give it any fuel to add to that fire that Zelensky wanted. He ended up saying, keep at it. And Russia has been clear. All Russian officials have been clear. They want a diplomatic solution. If there's no diplomatic solution, it will be one on the battlefield. Everybody from top to bottom has said that. Diplomatic solution, we're ready. No diplomatic solution, all achievements in the special military operation will continue until the root causes are addressed. And that's a fact. And that's a fact. That's why he says, you know, as you were saying, from comrade soldiers, comrade sailors, comrade admirals, generals, keep at it. Keep at it, you know, and he also was emphasizing that we are with you, like the whole nation, that they are the ones who are keeping the nation going. And that's true. There are now almost a million people fighting in all different walks, whether it's in the army, the navy, the marines, the paratroopers, in the internal security forces. Everybody has been mobilized to ensure the safety and the defense of the Russian Federation. And you can see the enemy is attacking civilians. It's not just attacking military. Certainly military, of course, on the contact line. But they're attacking civilians. They're attacking trains. They're attacking
children.
They're attacking buses. They're attacking schools. All of these things. And we remember last summer where they were booby trapping toys and objects and things like that. All of these things are part of the terroristic nature of the regime. So you cannot win by diplomacy on, number one, a person like Zelensky who has not been reelected. He's really a dictator. If you want to have, you want to know the dictator, it's not President Putin who's been actually elected by an electoral process every time that's necessary with full transparency. It's Zelensky who hasn't been reelected. He's now way past his term. And the regime that continues to use itself as a clearinghouse for the worst crimes. Human trafficking, weapons trafficking, you name it.
Biolabs.
Biolabs, all of these things that have been reported on. That's what's happening over
organ
there.
Organ harvesting.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know, the thing is, too, it comes to a point where you're asking, Zelensky's illegitimate. And mm-hmm. there's no question he's illegitimate. So how could Russia count on any written documents or agreements if you have an illegitimate president? Because then what the U.S. or the West or the Europe can say is, oh, well, it's not legal.
Sure.
So I understand, too, from a legal point of view, it's they really have to have a legitimate person.
Absolutely.
To make these agreements, and they don't have that.
Absolutely.
With Zelensky.
You're
so I had been for the last year amazed he's still there. He's still where he is.
Yeah.
But we'll
he's
see.
He's not going anywhere. I don't think.
You know, I guess the Americans are kind of done with him, but the Europeans keep him on, you know, thread. And that brings me to the question about Europeans. I saw a couple of them backing off, right? They're backing away from Zelensky. Germany is like maybe talking about trying to, you know, reconcile a bit, which is surprising because Germany's been pretty adamant about moving towards this. Do you see any movement with Europe away from Zelensky, or is it just theater again?
I think it's theater. And actually, okay. I was shocked when Scott Ritter was at SPIEF, and he openly said, we had the great panel session there, and he openly said, Europe is a rabid dog and it needs to be shot. And everybody was kind of shocked. Everybody was shocked.
As straightforward as he can be.
Everybody, and people were like, you know, calm down, Scott. He got in his Marine Corps. You know, we had that rector, you know, the head of MGMO sitting on the panel. Everybody was kind of like, oh my God, all diplomats. And he was like, I'm just a simple Marine. And that's where he went. He went for the jugular, right? He went for the jugular.
Yeah.
And I think that, listen, Europe now, and I can say this as a Greek dual citizen, Europe now is moving towards a European army, which is something that has always been feared. A European army. Germany is remilitarizing, which was the fear of Stalin and everybody during that period of time.
Okay.
You know, my God, keep Germany divided, because if it comes back together, this is the...
They've started two other world wars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we understand the history and the trajectory. Yeah. And now, once again, we have German tanks in Kursk Oblast, like last year before. And you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, they're back, right? The fear is that the remilitarization, the rearmament, the full-on Russophobia that's now captured the elites from the Baltics to all the way to the Atlantic. The fear is that the European continent is preparing itself for war again with Russia. And Russophobia has become the dominant ideology of the ruling class. Think about Ursula von der Leyen, Kaya Kallas, the whole gang of them. Would they still have their positions of power if Russia was a friend and they were able to do business and gas was cheap and people were living a good life? Probably not. They'd be long out. There's no need for that. But they keep the fear-mongering, which allows there to be a split politically. You have the sovereigntist movements that have come up. But you see that they're not always resilient. So we had Orban, who was in power. Then now we have Peter Magyar. So that whole situation changed, right, in Hungary. We don't know where it's going to head. Of course, we still have Fico. We still have the Czech Republic's president. But, you know, overall, we heard from AfD that were at SPIEF. And we were able to interact with them, but they won't have a clear majority in the Bundestag. Mm. So Germany itself, yes, there's a section of the population that wants to have a sovereign policy, that wants to be friends with Russia, but there's another part of the German population that doesn't want that, that still has this kind of very liberal idea and hawkish attitude towards Russia. That's my fear. And my fear is that in this situation, that Europe is preparing itself and gearing itself up for a long, protracted war with Russia, whether it's economic, and we have another sanctions package coming down the line, whether it's actual military confrontation or supporting proxies for military confrontation. But their involvement, not only in Ukraine, but also NATO and Sweden coming into NATO. Also, you had in Georgia, now in Armenia. You see what's happening in Azerbaijan. All these places, Europe is trying to extend its tentacles and trying to really do what the U.S. at this point is maybe partially not so interested in, at least for diplomatic reasons. Mm-hmm. They're continuing it by other means.
Yeah.
And that's my fear. My fear is that we need to be prepared for a long, drawn-out process. And that's why I think that we've seen President Putin goes to Beijing, heroes welcome, and we see further integration and relations. Russia-China, Russia-Iran,
Russia-Middle East,
South Africa, Brazil. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that BRICS Plus is becoming more important. And President Putin addressed it. Much more economic exchange being done in national currencies, greater trade. And I don't know if business will go back to usual with Europe. Certainly, there are still businesses that are here. There were German businesses there at SPIEF. There were American businesses. Some haven't left. But it will not be the same as it was in the 90s, and Putin is not Yeltsin, and we don't live in that time period anymore. The world has changed, and everybody has to understand that the US cannot continue to, and the Europeans, they are not colonial and imperial powers anymore. They have to play as equals. If they don't want to be equals, then confrontation becomes the necessary outcome.
That's my conversation with Kirill Dmitriev. He also confirmed that like, the dialogue with the United States is ongoing, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the Europeans are doing their best to torpedo the dialogue.
For sure.
So, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's yeah. If they're saying the opposite, unfortunately, most likely it's just a play. It's just a theater play. But we are running out of time. But
I
also have like one question, but we'll shift gears completely. Because from what I know, just last week, United States hold a training, like a Maduro-style kidnapping training in California. Mm-hmm. So do you think they're really preparing for Maduro to zero operation in Cuba soon?
Yes, that was my question.
Oh, yeah. You see,
for both of you.
That was my question.
For both
of you. Mine, yeah.
For both of you, good. So Cuba, I'll address Cuba. So I had the great opportunity to study in Cuba, the University of Havana, in the Department of Philosophy and Political Science. Dr. Talia Fung was my professor there, who was very close with Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, with the whole crew. She was a revolutionary. She passed away last year. For me, Cuba is the last bastion of the real revolutionary fervor, along with Nicaragua. And I saw Ortega's sons at SPIF. They're fantastic. They're good friends. I've been to Nicaragua before. This was Bolton's troika of tyranny: Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. Right, just like Axis of Evil. Mm-hmm. They love using this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know.
And they love the Trinity for some odd reason.
Samples, but samples,
yeah. Exactly, exactly. Cuba, they see Cuba as very weak now. And they see that everybody's occupied, preoccupied with war here, struggles there, in Middle East, everything like that. So they know that Cuba is vulnerable. But they don't understand the Cuban people. I do think that the Cuban people will resist in a different way than Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Cuba has a different history than Venezuela. And Venezuela is a sad case. My good friend Alex Saab, who's now in prison, I met Maduro last year as well. But Cuba is a different case. And if they do a style, a sort of operation to kidnap Raul Castro and to bring him to the US to stand trial, I do think the Cubans will resist. Whether they're successful or not, I don't have a crystal ball.
They can learn from the Iranians.
They certainly
are. The whole world, that asymmetrical response
absolutely.
Is a proper thing to do.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And if people understand Cuba, they understand that in every local neighborhood, barrio, region, there's a CDR, a Committee for the Defense of the Revolution. They are armed. Cubans have armed their population. Mm-hmm. They are trained and they are ready to struggle. Listen, Cuba has been through a lot in its history, and Cuba has been strangulated for decades from what we call a genocidal blockade. Yeah. They have stopped Cuba's development with every single tool and instrument that they have, America has, because they believe that Cuba is their cash cow again. Cuba, before the revolution, was like a giant brothel. It was for the mafia, it was for the elite, it was for gambling and casinos, it was for sugar, and the people lived in poverty. It was like feudal times.
Yeah.
So when they resisted and overcame all obstacles and were able to get rid of Batista and accomplish the revolution, the U.S. never forgave them, not for the revolution, but for seizing the assets of American companies and businessmen. That's what was unforgivable. That's when relations
money
ended.
Again, eh?
But what
of
you
course.
See, even with all that blockade, what's amazing to me is Cuba is number one in the world for literacy.
Absolutely.
And they just developed an anti-cancer
Absolutely.
Vaccine. I
Absolutely.
Mean, and the innovation that took under those conditions, I can't even imagine.
By the way, from what I know, the biggest percentage of students in any country in the world is in Iran, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Listen, Cuba exports doctors. The U.S. exports bombs. Cuba has exported its medical personnel all over the world for free. For free. That's why they go to school for free. To become doctors and nurses for free, they have to then go, and that's their payback to the government,
is to go
to Angola, Namibia, Venezuela, Brazil, you name it. They were also went to European countries during COVID. Mm-hmm. Imagine, Cubans, under the worst sanctions. People are like, oh, it's an impoverished country. The best doctors and nurses, they went to Italy to help with COVID. They went all over. Yeah. So for me, Cuba is a resilient society. It's a society of dignity, and I believe that they will continue to resist. What happens afterwards, I'm not sure, but the U.S. exposes itself every time as the bully, as that schoolyard, you know, gangster that everybody hated. And I believe that the Cuban people as a people of dignity will resist in all the ways that they can.
Thank you, Chris. That was an amazing conversation.
It was. Thank you so much. I really wish you luck on your Russian citizenship.
And thank you so much.
I hope that there's a public ceremony or a meaningful one, however they decide to do it. And we can all celebrate with you. And we'll have next time some bubbles.
Thank you.
To celebrate.
Yeah, we'll have you on our show when you are our compatriot. So
yes,
we'll have three Russian citizens at the table.
I love it. Thank you so much. Thank you to you both and for your great show. And if everybody is watching at home, please like, comment, subscribe, and share, and continue the great work that you're doing.
Subscribe to Chris on social media as well.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. We'll try to bring more exciting guests to our show. And please send us your comments, your guest suggestions, what you already do, but keep on doing that. Keep at it, brothers. And take care.
Take care.